5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Merkle Media.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary is Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison? Swingles in Fort Lauderdale.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on Rockfin, Odyssey, Band.video, Vigilante.tv, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thank you so much. We appreciate your amazing support. We couldn't do it without you. If you want to connect with me, the website is theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at Macroaggressions. Hey, if you like the show, take the additional step of rating it, maybe writing a little review. I don't care so much, but the algorithms, you know, they love it and all that good stuff. Thank you to our sponsors. They make this show happen. Legal Shield, it's been in business for 50 years. I mean, half a century. They have an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau. And thank goodness we found them. They are allowing all of us access to high-powered attorneys at a very reasonable price. $1 a day, $30 a month will get you access to a lawyer in your area that can help you with all kinds of things. Paperwork, you have a last will and testament that you need done, medical power of attorney, financial power of attorney. You can knock all of those things out in your first month as a member. You can sign up and take care of all of that. If your work wants you to sign some employment agreement and you're a little unsure about it because it requires you to agree to some sort of experimental medical injection or something and you're not sure, send it to your lawyers. If you've got paperwork, anything that you think, you know, you're unsure of contractually, you can send that to your lawyer. If you are a person that runs a small business, big enough to have your own business, but not quite big enough to have your own legal department, there is a small business plan for you as well. If you're somebody that carries a gun. They have legal documentation for you for that as well, or Identity Shield, all kinds of things. There's a ton of things that they offer. I'll tell you, the best thing you can do is just go to the website that is created specifically for us, www.don'tgetpushedaround.com. You can just check it out for yourself, see what you think, see what you see if there's something there that works for you. It's been working for a lot of people. They tell us equal justice under the law, but man, I'll tell you, nobody buys that anymore. If you've got a well-versed attorney, things seem to go your way. So this is a way to level the playing field a little bit more for us. And look, it's a reasonable price, something that I think everybody could probably afford. So take a look. Don'tgetpushedaround.com. And also, My Patriot Supply was nice enough to build us a landing page, preparewithmacroaggressions.com. I'm not trying to scare anybody. I'm just saying, let's be proactive instead of reactive. If you know that there's going to be issues with the food supply or supply chains or things like that, God knows, or Bill Gates is buying up all the farmland, airplanes are crashing into food processing facilities, livestock are just up and dying for no good reason. I mean, look, there's a lot of nonsense going on. You want to have yourself set up with food, obviously. If you're already taken care of, maybe there's somebody in your life that, you know, needs a little help. If you want to go and take a look and knock that out in like 15 minutes, you can do it. Preparewithmacroaggressions.com is the website to take a look. They can get you sorted out. They'll just deliver you boxes of food that will last you for 25 years. So take a look, see what you think. If it's right for you, pull the trigger. If not, that's okay too. Well, I wanted to get the business out of the way as quickly as possible because we have a returning guest, a returning champion, as Sam Tripoli would say. The host of the Corbett Report. I don't know. Do we need much of an introduction for James Corbett? He's been doing it for 15 plus years. I don't think so. Ladies and gentlemen, the great James Corbett is back. Hello, James. Good to see you again.
No, I demand a lengthy, voluminous introduction listing all of my great... No, okay.
Well, you're going to have to go to Greg Carlwood for that, because Greg will give you a really good intro that'll blow you away. I'll give you the short version. Now, everybody knows you. Everybody knows your work. And, you know, I mean, I think in some ways everybody has been, you know, it's hard to say how you woke up to this or who was inspirational to you. And it's sort of a mix of everything, but you were part of my awakening as well. You know, I mean, the stories that I heard about from you that I would have never found anywhere else. I think a lot of people, you know, I think they obviously appreciate your level of detail and the amount of work that you put into this, but also just the fact that you could deliver some bad news in a way that kind of funny. You know, you made it easy to digest, and I think people really appreciate that. So what's been, I'll tell you, I was curious to get your take on this, especially because you're somebody that has the ability to kind of peek behind the curtains and see what's going on here. But this whole, I don't even think I've even talked to you about the Russia-Ukraine thing. And frankly, I'm just exhausted talking about it. But the Wagner Group component. This is a relatively new thing. The private mercy, the Blackwater of Russia, right? The Eric Prince is so jealous. They had a coup, I guess, apparently. I don't know. Did they schedule it? It seemed like very performative to me. I mean, we've got Zelensky, who is actually an actor. So, I mean, I guess we're not too far off. What was your take on this? Was this real or was this some sort of performance art?
Well, let me preface my comments on this by saying that I am sick to death of the stuck on stupid comic book conversation that surrounds this topic in the so-called erstwhile independent alternative media that really has a propaganda line that everyone seems to be singing from the same hymn book. And I don't know, I don't have that hymn book, so I'm not going to sing from it. But the idea that is propounded in almost every corner of the alt media that I see is that Russia, great. Putin, Russia is Putin. It's a monolith, and everything that happens in Russia is Putin, and Putin is a good guy who is fighting the evil West, and everything Russia does is good. Anything bad that happens in Russia, of course, is a CIA plot, etc. And I'm sick to death of hearing all of that nonsense, especially from English speakers who don't speak a lick of Russian, never read a Russian source, don't live in Russia, don't know anyone in Russia, but man, they're going to tell you what's happening in Russia. So please do not come to James Corbett for the detailed, in-depth analysis of what is happening in Russia in the internal political system there and the rivalries between the various oligarchs and things that are happening. I wouldn't ask that of anyone. I would question your intelligence if you were asking for me for that level of detail. I know you're not doing that, but I know that there are people out there who don't, because it's never stated, it's never openly talked about, it's never even thought about. You know, why am I listening to this person, you know, in America or wherever they are in the world who doesn't even speak Russian about their analysis of Russia? It is stupid. Anyway, just like absolutely every corner of the world, anywhere that anyone is listening to us in this conversation will know, can you imagine if your country, your entire country was defined by the actions of its erstwhile president or prime minister or whatever, and everything is just boiled down to that, and everything that happens in the country is the result of this or that? It's just stupid. So anyway, if you want a different perspective, I recently had a conversation with a blogger called Rolo Slavsky, who has a very different take than what you're probably going to hear in a lot of the corners of the independent media that I'm talking about, where essentially what he is talking about is the very voluminous backstory to this really crazy events that have happened in the past week that didn't just happen in the past week. This has been building up for months and months, years, really, if you want to go far enough back. And it involves personal beefs between this CEO, head of the Wagner Group. I guess it's probably Wagner, but I'm a dumb Canadian. I'm just going to say Wagner.
That's fine.
And the Minister of Defense there in Russia, Sergei Shoigu, and what was their beef and what was happening between them, and why was Wagner Group being used in Ukraine, but then they weren't being fed supplies, and there was this crazy videos that were going on. So there's this huge story surrounding this. It didn't just come out of nowhere, and it's not necessarily just some sort of CIA plot. There are genuine factions and rivalries and oligarchs and struggles and things that happen in Russia that are not just part of some fabricated, you know, Western intelligence thing. Of course, this does play into the hands of the evil Western NATO empire that I constantly decry, because of course the first thing people will hear when they hear me talking about this, well, you're for NATO and you love everything. No, in fact, I have been put on the prop or not Russian propaganda list precisely because the thing that they cited in that anonymous prop or not thing that was going around a few years ago was my work specifically talking and calling out NATO as the force, the greatest threat to the planet, or whatever that particular video was entitled. So no, I am not a NATO fan. I know that the Western intelligence is eyeballs deep in Ukraine and everything that's going on there, and that this is part of a much bigger proxy war that's going on, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not defending NATO, but I'm not defending Russia either. I think every person who presumes to rule over a population is inherently evil, but also specifically the things that is happening in Putin's Russia is evil, including all of the biosecurity nonsense that we have seen in every other country in the world is happening in Russia too, including the potential introduction of the QR codes and the scanners and the vaccine passports. And oh, don't worry, they've got the good Sputnik V vaccine, which is literally a direct copy of the AstraZeneca vaccine. But don't think about those details, guys. Again, as you can see, I am just sick of people standing up for Russia in the independent media as if they are crusaders who are going to save us from the evil Western empire. It doesn't work that way. Anyway, I presume that you are not a statist like myself. I am not a statist. You're not a statist. So we can see through this. But unfortunately, a lot of people are still clinging to the idea that if they just back the right leader, he will lead them to glory. And I'm saying, I think there's some crazy stuff that's happening in Russia that isn't necessarily part of a Western plot.
Yeah. Well, agreed with all of that. I mean, there is a tendency to dumb it down and say, well, you know, this is the good, who's the good guys in this? It's like, well, is it possible that there aren't good guys? I mean, we're talking about war. And people ask me, like, what's your policy on, what would you say your stance is towards the world? I'd say, I am anti-war first and foremost. So there's, you know, I'm not going to cheerlead a war that Russia started, and I'm not going to pretend like it was, you know, in the West, Western media's, unprovoked attack. That's the term they use. Unprovoked attack. It's like, oh, it wasn't really unprovoked. I mean, I'm not in favor of war, but let's also not pretend like it was unprovoked. I mean, they've been messing around for a long time. And also, if we're going to get real honest about it, there are issues back in World War II and far before that that has always been a problem between, you know, Ukraine and Russia and the relationship they have. It is complicated, and it is not an area of expertise for me. Like you said, I don't speak Russian. I've never been to Ukraine. I don't understand the ins and outs, the infighting, that history, how you could live in Ukraine but be ethnically Russian. I mean, I'm trying to look around the United States and understand, like, is there an area, could I make some sort of comparison of, like, an area, like, what if Massachusetts was, like, ethnically Canadian, you know what I mean? And, like, I'd be like, well, and then Canada invades America, but they don't go really hard against Massachusetts. I mean, the whole thing, like, I'm not going to pretend.
Can I just interject with something there? Because you raise an important point.
Please.
I would invite people to just take a look at whatever analyst you like in this sphere with regards to Russia and look at what they were saying, say, in January of 2022, when the State Department started floating all this stuff. They're going to invade Ukraine, guys. They're going to invade Ukraine. And look at the analyst and see if they were saying, yes, great, Russia should invade Ukraine. Or were they saying, no, that's garbage U.S. State Department propaganda. They're not going to do that. And then in February of 2022, did they change on a dime and say, yes, this is good. It's part of the Putin's master plan. Great. And look at this. They're storming across the country right to Kiev. This is all going to be over in 5 days. It's the biggest win in the history of military interventions anywhere. Except when they pull away from Kiev and none of that materializes into any sort of military victory. But that's okay, because that was part of the plan, guys. It was a feint and they were just diverting those Ukrainians. Man, Putin is winning so hard in the Donbass. And now I guess the plan has always been and was from the very beginning to keep sending Russians into this meat grinder for month after month after month after month after month after month with no decisive military victories and nothing to show for it. This is all part of the plan. He's winning, guy. Where have you heard this type of analysis before? Personally, I got sick to death of hearing this analysis about Trump and how hard he was winning, guys. And James, you just don't get it. Trump's a great guy and he's going to save the universe. If only Trump was in power when the scamdemic hit. Oh, wait. Oh, Operation Warp Speed. Trump, his greatest accomplishment was getting warp speeding the vaccines in everyone's arms, right? Yeah. People just keep falling for the same nonsense over and over and over because they want to believe it. And I get it. I want to believe it too, but it's not real. And we have to stop believing in nonsense just because we want to believe it.
Well, I've got to give you credit too, because you and I talked about, speaking of COVID, you and I talked 2 weeks into COVID. It was the tail end of March 2020. And you said to me, and I'll never forget this because it was so, and you prefaced it by saying, I don't want to give these lunatics any ideas, but I think they already have the ideas. But like, what if it wasn't overt martial law, like tanks and troops on the street corners? What if it was a little bit more, I don't know, covert, a little bit different? What if it was medical martial law? What if they convinced everybody to stay in their house and they made it really fun the first time around, and then they opened the doors and said, go on out, you're free. And everyone said, remember lockdowns? We ate Haagen-Dazs and we watched Netflix and we got Peloton delivered to our house and we were working it from home and it was great. We spent all the time with the kids. And then the lockdown, the second time, they said, oh, lockdowns again, and they brought you in the house, and that time, and they don't let you out after that. And I thought, oh God, James, you know. You know, you might be onto something here. And the medical martial law component of that was spot on. I mean, you saw what was going on. And I think this just has to do with, you know, a lot of practice, a lot of insight into how these lunatics think.
It's not because I'm a genius. It's because they've been openly talking about it for decades. That's why I had my medical martial law podcast back in 2009. At that time, showing all the infrastructure that was being laid out for exactly what we saw in 2020.
And we walked right into it. And they set this trap and we walked right into it. So I wonder, since you are, you know, not Nostradamus, you're just somebody that reads their reports and then takes them at their word that they're going to try to put in place what they're writing about. Where are we going from here? Because we've got more simulations. We've got more, you know, we hear they test market things every now and then. Some of them work, some of them don't. Monkeypox, it didn't really work. And then you hear, a hemorrhagic fever and stuff. You know, oh, that sounds really scary. It's a long, but that's such a long name. And we have so many dummies in America. They'll never be able to say that. So where are we going now? Where's the United Nations taking us? Where's this? Is this a World Health Organization global health takeover? Is that the way this is all going to get folded into a world government? Are we just going to be grouped up regionally? Like, what's your take?
Well, I want to say this isn't going to be one particular thing. It's going to be everything. But there was no handy dandy word to say that until the Bilderbergers, WEFers, whoever it was, came up with the wonderful term polycrisis, because I think that's probably the word for what we're heading into. So for people who want sort of the philosophical, legal, judicial background to what we are heading into, I would suggest they check out a podcast that I released early last year on states of emergency, where I made the bold proclamation that we have entered a new era of political history, essentially, in which the new governing paradigm of the planet is rule by emergency. And it was interesting. I had been thinking about that concept and trying to lay it out in a podcast for months before the point at which I released it. And then I released it, and I think it was literally a couple of days later, the government of Ontario declared the state of emergency over the Freedom Convoy, which became the Emergencies Powers Act that Trudeau invoked and all of that. So, wow, it's weird when you do this work, some of the synchronicities and things that happen and things that are just floating around in the zeitgeist. But anyway, I think that's sort of what we have to grasp, is that we have entered this paradigm where it is constant emergency and crisis, which will be the justification for whatever's coming next. So, yes, will there be more bio-related events? Absolutely. I'm sure they're not just going to put that gun back in the holster and never use it again. Obviously, part of the point of the past few years has been to set the infrastructure for subsequent events. And we all remember Gates laughing maniacally about, oh, they'll pay attention next time to the next pandemic. And he was writing about pandemic two, pandemic II, like World War II. We're going to have to fight like World War II and blah, blah, blah. I wonder how he knows all this and all of that. So, yes, there will be more with regards to that. And the thing that I've been concentrating on quite a bit lately is the WHO's pandemic treaty and the amendments to the international health regulations, both vectors, if you will, towards the utter obliteration of any idea of national sovereignty. Obviously, as this non-statist, I don't like to put it in those terms, but hey, we're heading in the wrong direction towards more centralization of control in the hands of fewer and fewer global oligarchs, as evidenced by the WHO and its actions over the past few years. So that is absolutely coming to further solidify into actual black and white legal documents that we are all expected to abide by what will happen in the event of the next pandemic, including such things as, of course, the creation of the digital health certificate infrastructure, which people might have seen recently. The WHO and the UN are adopting the EU's digital health certificates that they rolled out over the past few years. And you might recall that the EU released some documents. Was it 2018? Anyway, I've linked to them before about their roadmap that they were going to have some sort of vaccine passport digital health certificate system in place by 2022. Wow, how did they know? Anyway, so that absolutely is on the agenda. And as I say, I don't think we're done with the bio scares. And probably, I would imagine that I don't want to speak things into existence. And as you say, this is what I was doing a few years ago, right?
Yeah.
Having said that, anyway, honestly, I think that the next vector on all of this will be a bio-warfare, bio-terror event that will be blamed on whatever convenient boogeyman that they want to pull out of the hat, whether it's Russia, China, North Korea, some shadowy terrorist group that no one's ever heard of before, whatever fits the agenda at that particular moment, some sort of bio-warfare, bio-weapon release. And hey, who knows? This one might be actually real and really deadly. It doesn't have to be, as we've seen over the past few years. They can make anything they want into anything they want, with media control telling people this is a big thing and you better not get sick. But anyway, there are bioweapons. Mosquitoes and ticks and other things have been weaponized. Where do you think Lyme disease came from? And why did it pop up near U.S. biological weapons laboratories?
We were told that that's a coincidence. Okay,
total coincidence. And if you look into it, you're a conspiracy theorist who deserves to be shunned from the face of the planet. Anyway, I think that is in the poker deck, the card deck, shall we say, that could be played at any time. But in terms of other things, as I say, it's the poly crisis, right? Yeah. So I definitely expect a monetary event in the coming years that will be the justification for the changeover to the CBDC paradigm. That will probably, I think they have to set up the digital ID infrastructure before that can really be rolled out in the way they want to roll it out. These things can happen simultaneously and in conjunction, but I think they need the digital ID infrastructure in place for the CBDC / social credit / ESG / whatever they come up with system that will be the control system. And generally speaking, when we think of monetary shift, paradigm shifting events, it generally comes with warfare. So, of course, the last major monetary shift, paradigm shift, was the creation of the Bretton Woods system, which, of course, happened at the tail end of World War II. And that's not a coincidence. It's because, hey, we've just blown up the entire chessboard. Time to put it back in order, in our new world order, as it were. So, unfortunately, I really do think we are heading towards some sort of hot war. And I don't even know what that looks like in the year 2023 or 2027 or whenever it happens. But I'm betting it won't be a good thing. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I was talking to Whitney Webb about that too. She was of the belief that the first component is that ID. That once you have that, you can build off of that. And you can really sort of track who's who. And then that becomes the... that gets tied to the CBDCs. And look, I know that finance is boring for a lot of people. And I know that people kind of glaze over when you talk about banking and I get that, but it's important for us to pay attention. You can hate banking whenever you want, but right now, the idea of programmable money that those lunatics are in charge of, to me, sounds like the hill to die on, and maybe they intend it to be a hill that we all die on too. But that this idea of allowing somebody to have, the fourth quarter Christmas numbers just came in and they were 16% below last year's. And, we just have to goose the velocity of money, get you guys spending again. So we've decided that, 20% of your CBDCs are going to expire in 90 days. So get to spending, you'll own nothing. And be happy, as Klaus says, because you can't save anything because your money is evaporating like a flip over an hourglass and watch it disappear. And so, you get the same creeping feeling about the programmable money. I mean, you and I have been to an Acapulco. We've heard Berwick talk about Bitcoin and Monero and these things, and this is great. This is a form of cryptocurrency. But I think the average person goes, oh, all of this is crypto. And you go, no. CBDCs are something different. So are you getting that feeling too, that they're going to use this CBDCs kind of blur the lines between what crypto is and isn't?
Yes. And for people who don't know my take on this, I would suggest they watch the Bitcoin PSYOP. I know there are a number of people who have heard that title of a podcast episode that I did a few years ago and assume that they know what that means, but I guarantee you don't know what that means from the title. But yes, essentially, of course, the idea of programmable money and central bank digital currency. Oh my God, this is that Bitcoin thing I was hearing about, right? Well, right. No, there is actually a bit of a difference here. And yes, the absolute core of the idea, the absolutely central kernel of the idea was decentralization. There is no central bank. There is no one who has control over this decentralized network. That is the entire raison d'etre of cryptocurrency, at least as it was originally presented. But what do? They steal the real and sell you back the fake, as James Evan Pilato at MediaMonarchy.com likes to say, and it's absolutely true. And in this case, here, guys, here's that digital currency thing you're talking about, Bitcoin, Monero, CBDC. whatever, just go with it, guys. And here's your digital wallet and it'll all be great. Yes. But for people, let's address that first point that you made, because yes, people's eyes glaze over when they hear about finance and monetary and blah, blah, blah. But this is the mechanism of control of human society. And people who don't understand that, I keep looking around for someone to come up with the definitive conspiracy realist version of history, as in from a monetary history perspective, because there is quite a tale to be told. But essentially, one way that I like to encapsulate the incredible importance of this subject, when I did my Century of Enslavement documentary several years ago, I vividly remember going through that history of, in that case, specifically the American central banking war that waged for a century and a half before the creation of the Federal Reserve, and the back and forth in that war, and how it was such an incredibly important central part of American politics for a very long time, and entire political movements arose on the back of this, and you had the Cross of Gold and the famous speech and the Free Silver Movement and all of the incredible tectonic shifts and movements that were taking place around this issue. And then 1913 and the creation of the Federal Reserve and the monetary issue and the banking issue goes away as a political issue and is never talked about again. Despite the fact that, as I show in that documentary, obviously the Fed has been behind every disastrous foreign policy misadventure, let alone everything else, for the past century of its existence. Again, no coincidence, because the spigot of monetary control is the key. And yes, they pepper it with all sorts of jargon and nonsense to make it, oh, who cares? But I can tell you, when Ron Paul was running in 2008 and you had entire arenas full of people chanting, end the Fed, that was a truly revolutionary moment. That looks like things that were happening, 150 years ago, back when people knew and cared about this issue and understood this affects me and my family and everything that I do in my life. This is a core central issue. And that awareness was being raised, but of course now it's kind of moved on. And what's the thing this week? I think Ukraine might be last week. What are we supposed to be concentrating on this week? So unfortunately, we may have missed that moment to seize on that opportunity. But at the very least, the conversation has been raised, and hopefully we can get more people thinking about this. But in that regard, yes, for people who don't know, the monetary system that we've been living under is not even the Bretton Woods system. It's the sort of the fallout, the shell hole that was left by the destruction of the Bretton Woods system back in the late 60s, early 70s, when the Nixon administration and the Vietnam debacle was going on, and suddenly France is sending ships to America to collect the gold because they realize that, I think America's making promises that they can't pay. And Nixon closes the gold window. You know what? That whole entire system that was set up at post-World War II to run the entire monetary world order, well, we're not going to do that anymore. So what are we going to do? Oh, don't worry. Kissinger, mini Rockefeller, swoops in to save the day with the construction of the petrodollar system, which the system, don't worry, we'll price oil in dollars, so everyone will need dollars for their oil, and the Saudis have agreed to shuttle all their dollars through the American banking system, so it all comes back to us. Don't worry, guys, it's still a stable system, until Saudi Arabia starts inching out from the American umbrella and starts making monetary deals with other countries, but that'll never happen. Oh, wait.
Yeah. So we're in this weird world where, look, when they set up that petrodollar arrangement, America was buying 2 million barrels a day of oil from the Saudis. And, it made sense. I mean, it's crazy, but we were the biggest customer. So maybe make some exceptions for the biggest customer. Now we're buying, 500,000 barrels a day? Guess who's buying 2 million barrels a day from the Saudis? Chinese are. So if you're Mohammed bin Salman, you go, I got these Americans over there. Just such a pain in the ass to deal with. Now I've got the Chinese. We don't get too bogged down with what our people think, really. We're kind of like, we're running our own thing. Hey, you buy 2 million barrels a day. You're my favorite customer. Petro Yuan, James Corbett? Petro Yuan, maybe?
Yeah.
Will that start World War III? Is that the trigger for World War III?
And you'll see some reports that I've done on it in the past. And I think we are seeing the erection of a, I won't even call it alternative monetary order, but at any rate, a the next stage of the consolidation of global control. Because as people may or may not know, search China and the New World Order or some of the other reports that I've done on this in the past. I think the creation of China as the economic slash military juggernaut that it is today didn't just happen by chance. It happened as part of the global consolidation plan and the coming war that I think will probably, unfortunately, I really do think we are heading towards hot war. But that doesn't mean, I mean, yes, real war, real people on the battlefield, real people dying, but being controlled at the top on both sides as World War One, World War Two, all of the major conflicts we can think of in our lifetime and beyond. So at any rate, yes, I think there is this push towards the consolidation of some sort of alternate system that actually isn't as alternate as you like to think. And one way of getting a handle on that, there are many different ways, but one way is to look at CIPS, which is the Chinese alternative to the SWIFT system. For people who don't know, the banks, in order to communicate cross-border transactions, they use this thing called the SWIFT network that is the standardized system for communicating information about transactions. And the SWIFT network is totally politically neutral, guys. It's run as a private corporation in Belgium or somewhere like that. And anyway, totally neutral, has nothing to do with politics. It's just a neutral platform for any bank in the world to communicate information about transactions and help with cross-border settlements. Except in 2011, 2012, when suddenly the US is pressuring SWIFT, and SWIFT decides of its own accord, guys, no political pressure, decides to delist Iran from the SWIFT network or Iranian banks. And of course, in 2020, Russia and SWIFT and all that. So the writing's been on the wall for quite a long time that the SWIFT network is one of those linchpins of global banking control that is wielded clearly in Washington more so than in Beijing, right? So China decides to set up their own banking communication network, CIPS. And I can't remember what that stands for, China Interbank Payment System, something like that. But as I wrote about several years ago, and kind of buried in the fine print of the details of the CIPS and how, at least how it was originally working when it was originally set up, they were buying network space on the SWIFT network in order to run their transactions.
Oh, really?
It was literally SWIFT, but don't worry, guys, it's CIPS. So I think the whole thing, just exactly the way Anthony Sutton revealed that the Cold War and the battle against the Ruskies was a charade. It was a game. It was pretend. Same forces were controlling both sides of the Cold War. I think the same forces are controlling both sides of Cold War 2.0. It's the same thing. But anyway, yes, some sort of new monetary system is being erected right now.
So you're Russia, you've got sanctions slapped on you by the US, and you look to Iran and you go, hey, you guys have had this happen to you. How do we get around it? And they say, well, go talk to China. China's got CIPS, and it's kind of a, you know, it's a workaround project for SWIFT. You can get on that. And you go, oh, that's cool. We can work this out. And they say, well, hey, by the way, we've got BRICS, right? Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. And we're a pretty good, powerful group. We've got, 40% of the world's population between us and 25% of GDP. I don't know. We're a player, right? We've we're just five countries. We're a big player. And we've got a dozen, 13 others that want to join. They have applications in. We've got even more that say they might be interested in joining. And now you start talking about a BRICS currency or a basket of currencies or maybe some special drawing rights or something along those lines, some sort of basket of currencies that maybe we could use. Now you start to see the dollar get a little weak. My question, I wonder, is like the dollar gets threatened. I mean, whether you're Gaddafi or Saddam Hussein, there's been a lot of people that have said, why are we using this dollar to pay for these things? Why don't we use the gold dinar? Why don't I trade oil for food or whatever? And then you get some democracy dropped on your ass from 20,000 feet, and all of a sudden those ideas go away. But not so fast with the BRICS system, because you really have big players involved in this. Is this the real threat, you think, to the dollar? A competitor, a competitive currency that maybe doesn't necessarily dethrone the dollar, but it siphons off some of the energy away from the dollar and makes it less appealing. And at a time when we've hyperinflated, I mean, frankly, we should be wheelbarrowing US dollars to the grocery store to buy a carton of milk at this point, but we're not. But at some point, is BRICS the real monetary threat to America?
Yeah, a couple of things to respond to there. One is that, yeah, should be, but we're not wheelbarrowing buckets of dollars to the store to buy a loaf of bread. Why is that? So anyway, again, pause for thought for people who have been listening to the people who have been screaming for the past two decades that hyperinflationary events just around the corner, guys, just around the corner. Well, they always seem to be able to kick that can down the road a little bit further, yeah. Don't they? So there's something to that that I think speaks to the fundamental nature of money itself and how it is essentially a confidence game top to bottom. And as long as the public believes in it, it will continue to function, essentially. But having said that, yeah, yes, right, okay. So I have to frame this in the right way, because again, people understand this in a certain way. Yes, does the sort of the rise of some sort of BRICS block slash trading block slash currency, is this a threat to the US dollar hegemony? Yes. Is this a threat to the globalist plan? I don't think so at all, because the destruction of the US dollar hegemony and the US monopolar world is part of the game plan towards the creation of the global government infrastructure. So this is all part of the plan. But yes, in that phony constructed controlled system, they have to scuttle the dollar. And that is happening right now. And this creation of this alternative, totally alternative system by these champion crusaders who are fighting against the evil globalists. But wait, what's Russia and China? What's their position on such things as central bank digital? Oh, they're way ahead of the pack. They are all, in fact, China is way ahead with their digital yuan, and the digital ruble is already being piloted and trialed and started. So yeah, you better believe they are 100% on board with the ultimate agenda of control over their citizens. And where do we get the whole social credit? Oh, right, the Chinese. That's right. They're going to be the saviors, guys. So again, you understand why I'm so deeply cynical about the people who are telling me that the BRICS are going to be the saviors of humanity. But at any rate, within the controlled paradigm that we're given, yes, the BRICS are a competitor to the US dollar hegemony.
Are they an actual but they're more like a pro wrestling competitor, right? Where they're going
to, I think that's the way to see it. And of course, again, let's not be comic book about it. This does not mean that I think that Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping and whoever else you want to name, if you can name anyone else in these governments, which is actually a good test for, would I listen seriously to someone who couldn't tell me who is the defense minister of Russia?
I've got
who
Sergey Lavrov, Dmitry Medvedev, Vladimir Putin, Shogu, and then that's all I got for you.
Yeah. And hey, mea culpa, I couldn't do a lot better, which is why I do not focus on the internal politics of these countries as if I'm going to tell you how these work. But yeah, something to think about. How much do you really know about these? Anyway, having said that, I completely lost the plot of what your question was.
Well, just wondering about like...
Oh, right. Sorry, theater. Yes. The comic book version of fake pro wrestling. It does not mean that I think there is a central script that's given by the ruler of the New World Order sitting at the head of the 13-person table giving everyone their script, and you must read the script. I don't think that's how this works. But who ultimately controls the development of plans is the financiers, as always, as ever. And the people who are financing one side or another get essentially to control who is winning in whatever stage of whatever economic slash geopolitical conflict is taking place, and then ultimately who wins in the end. So I think we focus on the shadows on the cave wall, the politician puppets that are dangled out in front of us as if they're leading the country and they're making decisions, guys. And yet, you know, who's the governor of the Central Bank of Russia? Or the People's Bank of China? Like, maybe some of these figures need a little bit more attention, huh?
Yeah, for sure. Well, last time you were on, we talked about when Obama had his pivot to Asia, right? And what that was and what that meant militarily. But I wonder now, Belt and Road Initiative, okay, this is a massive plan. It feels a little money laundering-ish to me. I don't know. Or maybe like trying to get money out of China as an option to get it out and then circulate it somewhere else. But, you know, from a geopolitical strategy standpoint, you are talking about allowing China to have access to many ports along this Southeast Asia, South Asia, up the, you know, into parts of even Europe to have a Chinese port. Is the Belt and Road Initiative what we are told it is? Is it really about trade? Is it really about, or is it about diversifying? Is it about connecting East and West? Or is it more like we want to have our guy, our Chinese guys in the ports, knowing what's coming in and out of these ports so that we can make moves accordingly?
All right. So I think it's important to understand. I will have to raise the specter of 3D chess, which I know has been thoroughly, completely trivialized over the past several years. But in my defense, I was talking about it a decade ago. And I think it does provide us with some way of looking at this. So as I've said before, I think there is the 3D chess game that goes on. And from the 3D chess perspective, you get to see that, for example, this team is working with this other team. It's just that we are generally looking at the 2D chessboard and we see these pieces kind of appearing and disappearing. Where did they go? Because we're not looking 3D, so we don't know what's happening on the board, right? So most people, I would say most people, even people within militaries and governments probably are on that 2D board and believe themselves to be in that nation state war that is going on. So from that perspective, yes, sure. If you wanted to build up China, if you, for some reason, somehow, I don't know, I guess the Chinese industriousness and pluck just sort of started to build momentum in the 80s for no particular reason and no banking agreements that we should ever look into. But anyway, China suddenly starts to become this economic snowball rolling downhill and gaining power and steam. And suddenly it's the second or maybe the biggest economy in the world, depending on how you measure that. And wow, you know, amazing. So how do you convert that economic capital into political, geopolitical capital? Well, of course, you start spending that money on infrastructure for connecting and trading with people. I mean, of course, it makes total 100% logical sense from the 2D perspective, right? Absolutely. That's what any normal, rational person would do in their national interest if they are playing that particular game. So yes, from that perspective, it is what it appears. Absolutely. It is a country that is using its economic capital to essentially buy geopolitical capital. Even from that perspective, I think we can, one way of sort of understanding what's going on, it would be like looking at, say, the US post-World War II, and you look at their Marshall Plan and the incredible amounts of money they spent, you know, building up Europe and spending all this money helping the poor people of Europe. You know, what a wonderful, magnanimous gesture on the part of the US that had, oh, wait, maybe the same people who would understand, oh, you know, no, of course, that's just them buying certain geopolitical capital in a new world order game that they're playing in order to create essentially the American empire, which, by the way, is not as benevolent, fluffy and loving as it likes to portray itself.
No.
Well, similarly, yeah, we could look at China starting to use their largesse to build up all this wonderful infrastructure that they're doing out of the goodness of their hearts because the Chinese people love the people. Oh, wait, no, of course, it's a cynical ploy to build up geopolitical capital. And of course, also to start the links that become the basis for various military linkages that come on later, right? And we started to see that with the construction of Chinese military bases and probably more to come, but that's the long way off. And so now everyone's concentrating on the economic capital. And the idea that there's debt trap diplomacy that goes on, that China is committing these countries to 99-year leases of this infrastructure that they're building out of the goodness of their heart. But by the way, you know, there's a lot of debt to be repaid on this, then you better be making your annual payments or we might come and possess some of your infrastructure. Anyway, there's a lot going on with regards to that. But yes, this is happening. And of course, it does. So again, from that 2D perspective, of course, this presents an obvious national security threat to the US and its foreign policy interests, which is why, for example, several years ago, I was writing about Balochistan or Balochistan, or it's spelled and pronounced different ways in English. But at any rate, the Baluchis, and their struggle for independence against Pakistan and what's going on there. And like, why is Dana Rohrabacher and George Clooney and others getting involved in this fight, as I was reporting on several years ago? oh, that's because the Balochi region is part of this port of Gwadar, which is an important part of this Belt and Road Initiative, getting Chinese goods out from Africa and up to Pakistan, where it could be shipped off by rail through the Chinese-Pakistan Economic Corridor. That's a key part of this whole Belt and Road Initiative. Oh, and that's why suddenly American congressmen really care about the plight of the poor Balochi people. So anyway, yeah, the 2D game is absolutely taking place, and there are a lot of people who are really fighting it. I just think there's more going on to it than that.
What do you think Saudi Arabia is doing? Because we've got MBS in there. He's taken over. He moved that the PIF under him. So he's in charge of the Sovereign Wealth Fund now. He's got a little under $1 trillion to play with. He's doing live golf. They're building golf. They're getting Formula One in Saudi Arabia, which sounds like a crazy idea to me. We've got a bunch of money. Let's whitewash our crimes against humanity and let's come out of this looking like we're really involved in boxing and MMA and, and all these. We're going to build the Neom City. We're going to build a floating octagon of industrial warehouses. We're going to build a 100-mile by 100-mile economic corridor in the middle of the fucking desert. You know, nobody cares about like it again, back to like, you're the Saudis. You're sitting on 70 trillion barrels of oil or whatever. You know, I mean, why would you be pivoting away from oil at this point? It seems weird to me that they've got all this money and that they're trying to buy a better reputation with a guy who has kind of a bad reputation for being in that head chopper kind of area. So, I mean,
kind of when it's convenient to point that out. But yes, okay, first thing we should point out is that the Saudi dynasty is one of the most disgusting blights on the history of humanity that has ever existed in the way that they rule over their people. But in a kind way, I suppose, because if you are actually Saudi instead of one of the foreign workers that they bring in to do all their menial labor, you at least get, or have always had up to this point at any rate, and a relatively cushy life with government guarantees and social system in place for you because of the oil largesse. But essentially that's buying off the possibility that they will be overthrown at some point. Because yes, when we talk about Saudi Arabia, it's the country named literally after the House of Saud, the Saudis, which is this royal family that again presumes to rule over the entire Arabian Peninsula because God put them in place, or more to the point, the U.S. and the British helped put them in place.
God, in U.S.
But
what's the difference?
Yeah, exactly. So that is important to keep in mind. But yeah, interesting, right? MBS is this horrible, bloody butcher dictator. When it's convenient to point that out, to sort of press the point and to get some better deals out of the U.S.-Saudi relationship. But when it's not convenient and when we're trying to get them to, you know, to do, don't go to China and, well, we need some more of your oil this week. Can you pump a bit more? And suddenly that goes away and you see Biden, like every other, like Trump and Obama and everyone before him, bowing and placating and doing the sword dance with the Saudis, of course. So, yeah, that's an interesting game that goes on there. And it is interesting, the relationship that the U.S. and Saudis have had in this petrodollar system, in this new monetary world order, because there is always that sword of Damocles hanging over the Saudis' head that, you know, we could go full on. We could talk about some of the interesting Saudi connections to 9/11. We could let people start suing in the U.S. system and getting information out. And then we could let the limited hangout of, yeah, look, it was those Saudis who did 9/11, I tell you. They could let that happen. Or, you know, you guys could play ball with us and we won't let that happen. So there's, I think that dynamic is going on as well. But again, I always want to pull back from the 2D picture to the bigger 3D picture and what's really going on the big, big scheme of things. And from that perspective, I think the Saudi relationship is one of the bellwethers of the shifting from the unipolar world to the multipolar world, which again, I think is part of the script, part of the plan. But when Saudi is firmly heading towards the Chinese sphere of influence is the point at which the old world order collapses of necessity, as I say, because the petrodollar system is predicated on that U.S.-Saudi relationship. So it's a pretty important one for understanding where the world is going.
It certainly is. I mean, the idea that the I mean, if a Bush was the president, either HW or W right now, I think the Saudis would be talking to the Chinese. Think that would ever happen under his watch with Bandar Bush as his guy in there installed, sort of make it, but it seems times are changing. I don't know. Is it because Joe Biden, they have no respect for him, or have we just gotten to page 64 of the script? And it's like, oh, this is the pivot away from the US.
Yeah.
Scene 37, the Saudis wake up and decide that they want to do business in the East more so than they want to in the West. Is I don't know.
No, more the latter. And I just got done saying, I don't think there's a literal script. So I'm going to have to come up with a better analogy for that. But maybe we could think of the financiers and the people really pulling the strings are writing a novel, and they know what's happening. They're the omniscient narrators who get to decide essentially who's getting the money this week and what, you know, who's winning this particular struggle. So they get to write what is going to happen, more or less. And the other people are unwitting characters in this novel play that's going on. I don't think they're literally reading from a script, but when times move on, so do the relationships. And I think that's exactly the point. It has nothing to do with Bush and Bandar Bush and their relationship per se. It's just that that was the particular relationship in time, in that place and time, for that particular agenda, which was part of the neocon agenda, which was part of a much bigger agenda towards the pinnacle, the zenith of the U.S. unipolar world that we've seen over the past two decades, which is also the point at which we start to see the decline. And what, U.S. can't even take Afghanistan after 20 years and they pull out and leave all their stuff behind? Wow, what a mess. It's almost, again, as if maybe the entire stage play that we've been watching isn't necessarily what's really going on. But anyway, I don't think it would matter if it was Bush or Trump or anyone else in the nominal position of the Oval Office at this point. The relationship is governed by forces that are beyond that stage of political power games.
Yeah. It's so fascinating to watch. I remember I went to high school with a bunch of Aramco kids that had gone to that whose family worked in Dahran and they lived there and went to school there, but school ended in ninth grade. And so they'd send them all off to boarding school for 10th grade. So I went to boarding school and we'd get all these kids that would come in. Where are you from? Like, we're from Saudi Arabia. You don't look Saudi. They're like, well, we're Americans, but we've been living there for a while. That was a big thing in the 80s and 90s. And everybody was, you know, we had this great relationship. Things have started to change. It seems like our relationship with the Saudis is a little bit more, I don't know, it's not quite as warm as it used to be. We have Blinken getting, you know, sort of denied, you know, not being treated with much respect from the Saudi. I mean, why would they, frankly? But to see this happen in our, you know, in the last, it seems like it's happening fast. It seems like it's accelerating. It's wild to watch. But let's wrap up on this, because I remember you doing an episode. God, it had to have been at least 2 years ago. And it was, and I think given the fact that we're in this real digital heavy world, and it doesn't appear that we're moving into an analog world anytime soon, you did an episode talking about salting your information. And I really like the concept of that. I really like the idea of not giving these bastards anything, you know, to make sure that the information that you are spit generating as a user of cell phones and computers and banking and whatnot, that we give them nothing to work with here. So what's some real easy tips for people that like to make things a little bit more difficult? Allow yourself even more privacy from the state watching you, but at the same time, make sure that if they're going to get any information from you, it's going to lead them nowhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Good question. Good topic. If people are interested in my full explanation, please do see that Solutions Watch I did a couple years ago now. Yeah. Salting your data. I think the simplest thing people can do is whenever you are being asked for any sort of information about yourself, the first thing you should ask yourself is this some sort of legal requirement? Like, am I literally going to be thrown in jail or charged with perjury or something if I don't answer correctly? And if the answer is yes, then you might want to think about what it is you're doing and what you're signing up for. Yeah, maybe for sure. You don't want to be doing that. But at any rate, if the answer is no, then why on earth would you provide correct, accurate information. It doesn't necessarily mean... So the example I used in that episode was Skype. I remember several years ago, on January 1st, I got all these happy birthday messages from various people on Skype. And I'm like, what on earth is happening? January 1st is not my birthday. Like, right. What is going on? And then I remembered, oh, yeah, of course. Because when I signed up for Skype, it asked for your age. It asked for your birth date, actually. So, of course, I put in January 1st, 1907. Like, what are you going to do? Why on earth would I give it my birthday, right? But, of course, then there was some feature in Skype that particular time. It's never happened again, interestingly. But anyway, at that particular moment, Skype decided, we're going to let everyone know it's your birthday, I guess. So, anyway, that was a good reminder. Yeah, okay, That's one reason why I might salt my data. Why does anyone need to know my precise birth date in order to use their service? I'm over 18. That's all you could potentially even possibly need to know, right? So anyway, it's things like that. Just basic little things. Don't provide accurate information if you don't have to. And then beyond that, another example that I point to in that episode, Ernie Hancock, Declare Your Independence. I hope people know about him and his show. He's often told the story about a friend of his who subscribed to like Ferret magazine or something. And he's like, well, what are you doing? You don't have a ferret. And he's like, yeah, that's exactly the point. I want whatever agent is watching my purchases to puzzle about that one and create wrong entries in my file. Right. It's just little things that you can do to throw wrenches in the works. And actually, you know, that's increasingly important as we head into the AI age, which is essentially, I mean, at base, it's this incredible data dragnet that is being used to construct the algorithms of the future. We are gladly feeding it all of our data, not only by what we're posting on social media and whatever, but people who literally sign up for, say, ChatGPT, which, by the way, you have to provide your phone number in order to sign up for it, which is why I haven't and won't. People are signing up with their phone number and then asking them all these personal questions and intimate things and revealing their inner thoughts. And that data is being snuffed up and put into the algorithms and being used to determine better ways to handle this or that segment of society for the coming polycrisis. And you better believe that, as I say, I don't know what the next hot war will look like, but I'm betting it won't look anything like Granddaddy's World War II. It's going to be very different, and it's going to involve algorithms that will be used to process what is going through your mind. And the more we feed, the more accurate information we feed into that data behemoth, the better they will be able to use that data against us. So stop giving them your information if you can. Give them wrong information if you can. Why on earth would you give them accurate information?
I agree. It stuck with me. It was an episode I watched a couple years ago. I just remember thinking, so smart. And I wouldn't have even considered it if I hadn't heard that. And now every time I'm asked to fill in data, I'm thinking about, you know, how can I mess with these people? And by the way, happy birthday. what are you working on now? What's coming up at Corbett Report?
So actually, as we're recording this conversation, you will note that I'm wearing this particular shirt, and you will notice this in my next podcast episode that should be out very soon, I hope, on further down the David Kelly rabbit hole, because we are fast approaching the 20th anniversary of David Kelly's death. And as people in my audience will remember, I did a Requiem for the Suicided episode on David Kelly several years ago, in which I went through the many, many reasons why absolutely the official story of his suicide is complete and total nonsense. David Kelly did not commit suicide. He was murdered. But that is actually sort of the trivial side of the story. Yes, David Kelly was murdered, and it's rather easy to see that. And here, there's this piece of evidence and this piece of evidence, this piece of evidence. If you want more, there's more to look at. But actually, there's a lot more to David Kelly than his death. And there's a lot more to what everyone at least remembers is, oh yeah, he was like a UN weapons inspector, and he was blowing the whistle about the 45-minute claim, right? That was what that was all about. Well, actually, David Kelly had a lot more connection into the very, very dark world of the shady shenanigans that were going on at Port and Down and what have you, that I think is worth re-exploring as we approach the 20th anniversary of his murder. So anyway, that's what I'm working on.
Nobody does it quite like you, James. You really are the best at this. You're able to take these complex topics or elements that have a lot of details condense them down into a video or an episode that just really makes a lot of sense. And I think the average person out there can connect with it, even if they don't understand all of the backstory. You make it simple for them. I think we really appreciate that. That's James Corbett, everybody. I mean, you know who he is. Go over and support his work, CorbettReport.com. Links will be in the description. If you like this episode, take the additional step right now of sharing it with your friends and family. If you want to connect with me, the website is theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. Thanks, everybody. I'll talk to you again soon.
As the holidays approach, it's time to return to the classics. Flaky pie crusts, perfectly browned butter, and cookies with just the right texture. And one ingredient you cannot compromise on is Kerrygold butter. Kerrygold butter is crafted with milk from grass-fed cows that graze on lush green pastures across family farms in Ireland. The result? A rich, creamy butter with a high butterfat content that elevates every recipe. Whether you're making signature shortbread or browning butter for a nutty depth in your pecan pie, Kerrygold makes all the difference. The flavor is unmatched, and the texture it brings to baked goods is simply divine. So this holiday season, if you're baking for loved ones or just for yourself, reach for Kerrygold. It's the butter of choice, and your pies, your cookies, and your cakes will thank you.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app, with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited, no purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps, in line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.